This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, May 2nd, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, President Barack Obama outlines plans to continue the war in Afghanistan. In Myanmar, pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi takes the oath of office to join parliament, ending more than two decades of exclusion by military rulers. And we'll go to India, where a series of abductions has rekindled the debate on the Maoist movement and the government's military response. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Israel has closed an investigation into an incident during the 2009 Gaza War where shelling killed 21 members of one Palestinian family. According to the human rights group B'Tselem, the family had been instructed to remain indoors by Israeli military forces. After the attack, which caused the house to collapse, Israel would not allow the injured to be removed for 2 days, and the dead were left in the rubble until after the conflict ended. In a statement, B'Tselem said, quote, "It is unacceptable that no one is found responsible for the deaths and that Israel has yet to open a serious investigation into alleged human rights violations during the conflict." In Cambodia, riot police struck protesters as they marched in the capital Phnom Penh today. The protesters were demanding compensation for losing their land as part of a controversial real estate development in the heart of the city. This comes as the government faces pressure to investigate the recent killings of a prominent land rights activist elsewhere in the country. FSRN's Erwin Loy has the story.
The protesters were residents of Bangkok Lake, a low-income neighborhood where thousands were evicted after the government awarded the land to a private company. The AP reports riot police keeping watch over the demonstration on Wednesday kicked several of the protesters, injuring at least five women. The government is already facing criticism in the unrelated death of Chutvati, an outspoken environment activist who was gunned down by military police last week. Authorities have announced they will hold an inquest into Vati's death. But former colleagues of the activists say they're not convinced the investigation will reveal what really happened. Marcus Hotke worked with Vuti on environment issues.
I guess the government has means to find out what really happened, but if it is made public, that is a whole other story.
Colleagues say Vuti had received threats to his safety before he was killed. The government insists it will conduct a full and proper investigation. Erwin Loy, FSRN, Phnom Penh.
Just hours after leaving the U.S. Embassy in Beijing, Chinese dissident Ching Wan-Ching told the AP he wants to leave the country and fears for the safety of his family. Chin, who is blind and had been on house arrest for 2 years, took refuge at the embassy last week. Chin left the embassy today for a Beijing hospital, according to the U.S. State Department, and has been guaranteed his and his family's safety by the Chinese government. U.S. officials say they will continue to monitor Chin's welfare. China is demanding an apology from the U.S. The Labor Department has awarded 4,500 Walmart employees a $4.8 million settlement for back wages and damages. The federal investigation found the company violated overtime statutes for vision care managers and asset production coordinators. The company said those employees were exempt from Fair Labor Standards Act overtime requirements. The corporation will also pay nearly $500,000 in civil penalties because of the repeat nature of the offense. Negotiations over back payments have been ongoing for 5 years. An Illinois House committee has approved a bill to halt plans for a private for-profit immigration detention center in a sleepy South Chicago suburb. That vote is considered the last real legislative hurdle, effectively ending a contentious battle between the cash-strapped village of Crete and Corrections Corporation of America. CCA is the country's largest private prison operator. The legislation extends an existing Illinois law banning private prisons to include immigration and customs enforcement detention centers. FSRN's Jay Saper reports from Chicago.
Corrections Corporation of America lawyers and lobbyists descended on the tiny rural town of Crete, Illinois, making an offer that was tough to refuse. Turn those barren farm fields into job-making, tax-paying prime prison real estate. Heated town hearings followed. Local polls showed Crete residents fairly split on the issue, but local opponents of the private prison received plenty of help from Chicago. Immigration rights groups Activists, religious leaders, and progressive lawyers marched 3 days and 30 miles to the town. The Sisters of Mercy's Joanne Persh made the moral case, and ACLU lawyer Ed Yonka went to motive.
No one should profit from human misery. We need to stop CCA.
No one wants to acknowledge what it really costs to detain people, so we farm it out to a private company. It's time to stop this madness.
The bill has already been approved in the Illinois Senate. Governor Pat Quinn has indicated he will sign it into law. Jay Saper, FSRN, Chicago.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. Today, the Taliban claimed responsibility for deadly attacks in Kabul that struck shortly after U.S. President Barack Obama ended a surprise visit to the country. The bomb attacks killed at least seven and wounded more than a dozen. Obama signed an agreement with President Hamid Karzai for U.S. troops to remain in the country in some capacity for the next decade. In his address last night, the president praised the progress in the war and said a new day was on the horizon. But some critics say a continued military presence will only exacerbate the violence and corruption that continue to plague the country. FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
Speaking from a U.S. military base in Kabul, President Obama described what the U.S. military presence in Afghanistan will look like after the official withdrawal in 2014.
We'll work with the Afghans to determine what support they need to accomplish two narrow security missions beyond 2014, counterterrorism and continued training. But we will not build permanent bases in this country, nor will we be patrolling its cities and mountains. That will be the job of the Afghan people.
The agreement announced Tuesday maintains some U.S. troops in the country until at least 2024 and guarantees their access to Afghan military facilities. The two countries have to work out exact troop and funding levels over the coming year, and the deal doesn't answer controversial questions about night raids and the management of prisons, which were recently hammered out in separate memorandums of understanding. The president emphasized in his speech that the goal of staying in Afghanistan is not to, quote, build a country in America's image or eradicate every vestige of the Taliban.
These objectives would require many more years, many more dollars, and most importantly, many more American lives. Our goal is to destroy Al-Qaeda, and we are on a path to do exactly that.
But the president's declaration conflicts with past statements by U.S. officials that al-Qaeda's presence in Afghanistan is dwindling. In 2010, then-CIA Director Leon Panetta said that less than 100 al-Qaeda members were operating in the country. The president also touted the progress made by U.S.-trained Afghan forces, who he promised would take the lead in combat operations beginning next year. But a report out last week from the Kabul-based think tank Afghan Analyst Network calls this transition into question. Their investigation found that the International Security Assistance Force used the term Afghan-led very loosely in describing missions, even for attacks carried out solely by U.S. troops. Afghan political analyst and Kabul resident Daoud Soltanzoy, a former member of parliament, says the agreement should have been crafted in a more transparent way.
It was signed in the middle of the night when it was very dark, and the people in Afghanistan were all asleep. This could have been handled much better. It should have been given more publicity.
But Soltanzoy supports a continuing U.S. presence in his country, saying a long-term commitment is the only way to effectively serve the needs of the population.
In the past 11 years, most Americans who've come with goodwill, with good intentions, not only the military, but the diplomats, the aid workers, civilians and military, all of them, they came, they were isolated from the people. Lack of continuity and their short stays in this country has not been conducive towards learning about this country enough to put that knowledge into the service of both nations and both countries' interests.
Soltanzoy added that another decade of U.S. troops on the ground will keep the population safe from militants both within the country and just across its borders. But after visiting Afghanistan earlier this year, Kathy Kelly with Voices for Creative Nonviolence is skeptical.
Pakistan and Iran and China and Russia, all in the neighboring countries in the region, has said they won't accept the strategic partnership agreement, and the Taliban have said they'll continue fighting. So this is subjecting people in Afghanistan to 10 more years of warfare.
President Obama expressed confidence that NATO would approve the treaty at the summit in Chicago later this month, but it first must win approval from both chambers of the U.S. Congress, where some lawmakers are strongly opposed to committing more dollars and lives to the war in Afghanistan. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
Today, students from across New York City rallied at Brooklyn College to protest rising fees and lack of access to public education. A Brooklyn College student told FSRN that police were blocking access to the campus and protesters had lined the gates.
This is an event about creating access to public higher education, and they're not allowing the public to a public college. So it's really telling. We're just here to talk about like issues such as tuition hikes and the privatization of our education, and they're like physically stopping us from coming in unless we already are able to pay for education and be students here.
Biola JJ is one of the organizers of the event and a member of the student union. She said students are calling for democratic change at the city's schools.
One, we need free higher education, and then we also need universities that reflect the background of the students, which means supporting ethnic studies, supporting women's studies. And then we also need more democratic control in our universities. If more students were able to make decisions about how the campus was run, then the campuses would run for the betterment of the students rather than the betterment of our administration.
Organizers called the action a continuation of May Day events from Tuesday that commemorated International Workers' Day. Marches and protests filled cities across the world, including Kuala Lumpur, Manila, Moscow, London, and U.S. cities. The events were mostly peaceful, but arrests were reported in Seattle, Portland, Oakland, Miami, and Philadelphia. Police in New York arrested more than 50, according to New York One, after hundreds stayed at Zuccotti Park late into the evening. A video posted on YouTube from earlier in the day appears to show white-shirted New York police pulling protesters to the ground as a crowd surrounds them. In Seattle, a mostly peaceful rally turned violent when about 75 protesters dressed in black broke off from the crowd and smashed storefront windows, according to the Seattle Times. In Oakland, police said 24 people were arrested. This week, a federal court monitor report found that Oakland police had used an overwhelming military-type response to confront Occupy protesters last fall and confirmed that police fired a beanbag round at former Marine and Iraq War veteran Scott Olson, who was critically injured. As FSRN's Andrew Stelzer reports from Oakland, the events on May Day saw thousands march through the streets, affirming that the movement is still alive and kicking.
A troupe of Aztec dancers and drummers kicked off what's become a traditional May Day immigrants' rights march beginning in Oakland's Fruitvale neighborhood. Ana Perez, the director of the Central American Resource Center in San Francisco, says she's been taking part in this demonstration, kicking off in a neighborhood of Latino immigrants, for the past 10 years. Her top demand is for the federal government to stop the recent increase in deportations.
The more that we bring all the different movements together, the better. You know, Occupy did a great job highlighting the economic injustice that most of us, the 99%, suffer. And so bringing those demands to the demands for immigrant rights, to the demands for labor rights, is crucially important. So I see it as a move of unity and power.
There were sporadic protests across the city of Oakland throughout May 1st, but this rally drew several thousand people. A woman who only gave her first name as Melissa has been involved in Occupy and the autonomous collective Decolonize Oakland since last fall.
I think that the traditional workers, that anarchists and some commies kind of like got together to organize back in the late 1800s, would be the same contingency of folks who are here right now.
Organizers had debated the march through downtown Oakland and whether immigrant families would participate. Police had already cracked down on Occupy earlier in the day, using tear gas and arresting several protesters. Still, by early evening, several thousand people arrived at the plaza in front of City Hall, the site of Occupy Oakland's encampment last fall. By the time dark fell, the numbers were under 1,000, and clashes between police and protesters began once again. Several store windows were smashed and a police car set on fire. Police made at least 25 arrests. Despite the tensions, many, like Veterans for Peace and retired union member Francis Grinnan, expressed optimism about Occupy's reemergence.
You know, movements are not just always straight uphill and just continuous. And you look at American history, the movements have a cycle. They go up and down. You know, people get tired. I feel like this is something like the 60s. There's something blowing in the land, but this is going to be bigger than the 60s because a lot of working people, a lot of middle class people are hurting. It's not just young people. So I think that we're in the very early stages of a major social movement challenging all the corruption and saying we can do better than this. We don't need just $13 trillion to go to the banks to bail them out and Main Street is left hanging. We can do better.
Grinnan says he's looking forward to the NATO summit in Chicago later this month as the next major street action for Occupy, labor, and other activists. Andrew Stelzer, FSRN, Oakland.
Activists canceled May Day events in Cleveland after the FBI arrested five men in a sting operation. The men are accused of attempting to use explosives to blow up a bridge outside Cleveland. In a statement, Occupy Cleveland said some of the men had attended Occupy events in the past, but, quote, in no way were representing or acting on behalf of Occupy Cleveland. Civil rights groups have criticized the FBI's use of informants in sting operations, calling it a form of entrapment. You're listening to FSRN. In a crucial step to reform Myanmar, opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi took up her seat in the National Assembly this week after her party won a landslide victory in by-elections. There is a cautious optimism about the future of Myanmar, the country also known as Burma, after five decades of military rule. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, on an official visit to the country, said change remains fragile and pressed for further reforms. FSRN's Ron Corbin reports.
Aung San Suu Kyi and elected members of the National League for Democracy took up their seats in the National Assembly Wednesday, marking a new stage in the country's political evolution. Suu Kyi, who spent 15 years of the past two decades under house arrest, told reporters at the administrative capital of Naypyidaw she was prepared to work with all members in the assembly, including the military.
We would like our parliament to be in line with genuine democratic values. It's not because we want to remove anybody as such. We just want to make the kind of improvements that will make our National Assembly a truly democratic one.
Sound courtesy of Reuters. Suu Kyi and the National League for Democracy finally agreed to accept the wording of a swearing-in oath after initially boycotting the first sitting of parliament. UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon, who this week completed a three-day official visit to Myanmar, told the Assembly he was confident the country could achieve reconciliation.
We know that Myanmar can meet the challenges of reconciliation, democracy, and development. The path of change is still fragile and uncertain, but it is indeed too narrow to turn back.
Moves to reform marked by Suu Kyi's NLD party winning 43 seats in the by-elections led a number of nations, including the United States, European Union, Canada and Japan, to ease sanctions imposed over past human rights breaches. But rights groups say full sanctions should remain until President Thein Sein's military-backed civilian government frees all political prisoners and ends military operations against ethnic communities, especially the Kachin and Karen peoples. Bo Ji, Joint Secretary of the Assistance Association for Political Prisoners Burma, says rights issues and an end to fighting with the ethnic communities should be a priority in Myanmar, formerly known as Burma.
You need to discuss with the immediate
Zuvina program Obama, especially stop the war on the Kachin state and then release of political prisoners and other human rights situation. So that is like the those three issues are really important. Without solving those problems, Burma will not get peace.
Others, such as Debbie Stoddard, spokesperson for rights group Alternative ASEAN Network, see substantial reform still being some way off.
The international community was pushing for the NLD to participate in the political process and to reform from within. And this is a litmus test as to whether that reform is actually going to happen.
Myanmar's 664-member Union Assembly was largely elected in a 2010 national vote that was described by analysts as fraudulent and largely dominated by military-backed parties. Under a 2008 constitution, 25% of assembly seats are allocated to the military. Aung Zor, editor of the online newspaper The Irrawaddy, says many in the administration remain cautious over reform, including proposed changes to free up the media.
This is a very crucial time. This is a transition time for the country, but we don't know where it will lead to. And the government ministers and some officials are very cautious, extremely cautious about letting the media to report freely.
In an early reward to reform, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, already granted Myanmar rights to host its annual meetings in 2014. The reforms that led to an easing in sanctions is already triggering increased interest from foreign investors currently influenced by China. Douglas Clayton, chief executive of investment house Leopard Capital, is optimistic over the outlook.
And we're very bullish on the development, and we believe that this is the beginning of Myanmar's transformation into a modern economy, and that there will be a role for foreign investors to play in that.
Labour rights groups say an easing in sanctions will benefit thousands of mostly female textile workers who will be able to return to work after earlier trade sanctions forced hundreds of textile plants to close. Currently, a quarter of Myanmar's 60 million population live below the poverty line of just $1.25 a day. But the Asian Development Bank says the economic potential lies in being endowed with natural resources, arable land, forestry, minerals, natural gas, fresh water and marine resources. Ron Corbin, FSRN, Bangkok, Thailand.
Maoist rebels in the Indian state of Chhattisgarh are demanding the release of prisoners in exchange for freeing a high-level government official they took hostage last month. Earlier, the rebels abducted two Italian tourists and released them after the government freed prisoners, including some Maoists. The hostage crisis has rekindled the debate on the Maoist movement and the government's response. FSRN's Bismillah Galani reports.
At Belipeta village in the eastern state of Odisha, hundreds of villagers and journalists greet Jina Hikaka after Maoist rebels set him free, ending a month-long hostage drama. Hikaka is a member of the state legislative assembly. The Maoist released him after the government agreed to free 25 prisoners, including some militants, and withdraw prosecution against 13 others.
So far, we have not got any information from Manish Kunjam, but only the media people have been posting updates that the medicines have been reached, but officially we have not got any information.
Miles away in the neighboring state of Chhattisgarh, Asha Menon, wife of district collector Alex Paul Menon, implores the Maoists to release her husband.
Please get us at least know what kind of situation he is in, because no communication has been made from my husband, and I'm just facing all those symptoms now, so it's been very difficult. We're just struggling through it.
The Maoists abducted Menon last month after killing two policemen guarding him. They are now demanding the release of 8 Maoist leaders and an immediate halt to the ongoing Operation Green Hunt. Operation Green Hunt is a military offensive the government launched in 2009 in 5 states to flush out the Maoist militants. but human rights groups say it has resulted in grave human rights abuses. Maoist militants operate in 2/3 of more than 600 Indian districts. In recent years, they have significantly accelerated their activities, launching deadly attacks against government security forces. Swapan Das Gupta is a senior journalist who writes frequently on defense and internal security issues.
If you take the figures from 2005 to about the middle of 2010, which I have with me, it suggests that there was about 1,082 people who died in the violence in Kashmir. Whereas in Maoist-related violence, something like 3,041 people died. So you get a sense that what we are dealing here is truly what the Prime Minister said, the most serious internal threat in this country.
The Maoists claim to be fighting for the rights of tribal people and rural poor. They have a strong support base across the tribal belt in western, eastern, and central India. These regions are also the country's most mineral and biodiversity-rich areas. Many say the Maoist movement is a direct response to the 6 decades of neglect and exploitation of India's tribal population. Manishankar Iyer is a parliamentarian and a former minister.
If there's any one segment of Indians whose lives have been completely disrupted by our current development process, it is the tribals, whose land is being sought for the minerals that lie below it and for the forest wealth that lies above it. And this is being exploited, including their water resources, without any regard for their own welfare and their own participation in it.
A number of mining companies operate in the region, including UK-based Vedanta and South Korean steel giant POSCO, that have been accused of environmental and human rights abuses. Maoists have urged lawmakers to block some mining projects, but many Indian officials support the billions of dollars in potential mining. The recent kidnappings have evoked strong reactions, with some political parties demanding a stern response from the government. Some of the Maoist supporters have also severely criticized the rebels for the abductions. Nandini Sundar is professor of sociology at Delhi School of Economics.
If you are a principled organization fighting for people, then you should stick to some basic principles.
Sundar is also the coordinator of the Citizens Initiative for Peace, a group that has been trying to bring the Maoists and the government to the negotiating table. But she doesn't see it happening in the near future.
The basic fundamental issues are not going to be addressed, like mining and so on. That is something that the government is really interested in pushing. And so, you know, it's not really going to be willing to have peace talks where that actually involves giving up any of that. And the Maoists are also not, there's a roadblock on their side too, because they also have this long-term goal of, you know, capturing the whole state. So they don't want to kind of give that up.
At the moment, the state government in Chhattisgarh has stopped the anti-Maoist operation. The government is also negotiating with the mediators representing the Maoists to facilitate the collector's release. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rilska Topchi and Shauna Ray. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.